welcome everyone back to New Books in Education on the New Books Network. This is Ryan Allen, your host for New Books in Education. And today I'm excited to introduce a book that we have, China's Rising Research University, A New Era of Global Ambition. And this is out of the Johns Hopkins University Press, and it's publishing later in 2014. And the authors that we have for this book today are Robert Rhodes, Xiaoyang Wang, Xiaoguang Shi, and Yang Sai Chang. And today with me for the interview, we have Robert Rhodes, who is the Director of Globalization and Higher Education Research, the Higher Education Research Center at UCLA. So a little bit about the book before we bring on Robert. This book looks at what is now the largest higher education sector in all of the world, and really just how the Chinese universities have been internationalizing and pushing for what comes up a lot, that we see this quest for world-class university standing. In the book, they ask, how are the working lives of professors changing at these leading universities in China? And the leading universities that they talk about in the book, because this book offers a wide description of the educational system, the higher educational system in China, but then it really goes into focus on four key case study universities. And the first one they talk about is Tsinghua University, and the next one is Peking University, the other one Renmin University, and then Minzu University, all located in Beijing. And so we can ask Dr. Rhodes why he chose those universities and what their significance are, all very different, but with very distinct characteristics that I think really guide and move the book along. And so without further ado, Robert Rhodes, thank you for joining me at New Books in Education. Can you maybe just give me a little bit your intellectual path? How you kind of got started in this book, maybe interest in China. And I know you kind of had some connections to the Fulbright program. You can talk a little bit about that.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. Thank you for having me on here on your show. Actually, I'm a sociologist by training and mainly an ethnographer. In the past, my work is mostly focused on the U.S. and universities in the U.S., although there was a period of time where I was also doing research in Latin America, mainly in Mexico and Argentina. Starting around 2004 or so, I began focusing more and more on China, primarily for two reasons. One is my ethnographic nature of wanting to explore complex and different cultures, and I don't think there's many cultures more complex than Chinese culture, which is such a long history. And the other source of motivation was the incredible change going on in Chinese society, but also in Chinese institutions, especially the educational institutions such as universities. And so I wanted to be part of that. It was a few years later that I actually started studying the language, Chinese language, Mandarin, and have been studying Mandarin mostly on my own for the past 4 or 5 years. Probably I would be in an intermediate level right now. I hope to eventually do all my ethnographic research in China in Chinese. I'm not quite there yet. And so this project really sprung from, in part, my Fulbright experience at Minzu University. Minzu is the leading ethnic minority university in China. Approximately 60 to 70% of the students at Minzu are ethnic minorities, and about 40% of the faculty are ethnic minorities. And so I was at Minzu for 1 year, collecting ethnographic data at the university. But previously, I had worked at Renmin University for a summer and had made multiple visits to Renmin and had actually done an ethnographic case study at Renmin University as well. And so during my Fulbright year at Minzu, I was actually working on the second case that would eventually be a multi-case study project. During that year, that's when I met my colleagues in Beijing, And that's when we decided to do a more of a large scale project and add Peking and Tsinghua University. You mentioned that all these universities are in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a strength and weakness of the book.
Right?
And not only are they in Beijing, they're on the same street.
Right.
This is one of the unique qualities of China's university system. First of all, there's no city in the world, to my knowledge, that has as many universities and university students as Beijing.
Mm.
Certainly no other city in China, even Shanghai, can compare to Beijing in terms of the number of students they have. This is in part why the Tiananmen protests were so massive back in 1989. You have 30, 40, 50 universities within walking distance of each other.
Mm.
You can walk from Minzu University past Renmin University to the gates of Peking University. Tsinghua is across the street from Peking. You can walk that route in about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how fast you walk. Okay, so I say that's the strength of the book, in that China has such incredible regional diversity that we, in effect, controlled for the diversity of the different regions of China by focusing on Beijing. The downside to that is that we really got a better portrait and developed a better understanding of what it means to be a research university, or what it means to struggle to be a research university in China, but specifically in Beijing. And you could argue that a university in Southwest China, such as Southwest University or Chongqing University, would probably exhibit some different cultural forms, some different cultural practices. That's all true, and that's a strength and a weakness to the study. Now, to add to that, the book is based upon four intensive case studies, but it also includes visits to 12 or 13 other universities throughout China, including Northeast China, Southeast China, Southwest China. The only region that really isn't represented is the western region of Xinjiang province, which is not the easiest place to travel to. And so the book does incorporate some of those kinds of understandings, and then also keep in mind my three co-authors are all Chinese professors of education, of comparative education, or of higher education. And so they have a rich understanding of the history and the diversity of the Chinese university. So those insights are built into different parts of the book, especially chapter one and the concluding chapter.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Yeah, definitely Beijing, having gone there a few times myself and going to visit these universities, it is quite definitely a spectacle to see for sure. So I guess moving right along into that first chapter that you mentioned, you open the book up with talking about how China had surpassed Japan as the second largest economy in the world, and then also how China had overtaken, sort of the U.S. and Japan in with the fastest supercomputer. And
right.
I'm wondering, why you open with these sorts of stories of how sort of China has overtaken or moved forward.
I'm just moving ahead to one of my PowerPoint slides that I'm giving later today.
Nope.
To talk about this book in my class.
No worries.
The reason I open with a variety of facts, some of them are not that significant. For example, China producing the fastest or the fastest supercomputer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That might change next year.
Certainly.
But it was just simply one of many indicators that life is changing in China. The ambitions of the country, of its political leaders, of its institutional leaders, is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Many scholars have acknowledged this early in the 2000s. There's a couple books I'm mentioning later in my class by Martin Jacques, When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of the New Global Order, The Dragon and the Elephant, China, India, and the New World Order by David Smith. And then there's The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise mm-hmm. of India and China, and what it means for all of us. That's by Robin Meredith. These books are all basically about the same idea,
mm-hmm.
that not only China, but India as well. And China really is far further along than India in terms of playing a leadership role in geopolitics. But the reality is that the world is changing and that China has become a major player in a variety of global spheres, economics, politics, culture, and that I begin in the book by highlighting that facet. Most of those examples have little to do with higher education or with research universities, although some of them do connect. For example, it's the National Defense University that produced that high-speed computer. And so some of those facts that I raised at the beginning of the book implicate the research universities in China, but are really presented to create this context, this broader context for how life is changing in China.
Absolutely.
So that's why I kind of begin that way.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's it sort of sets the table nicely for the rest of the book and what's to come. And so it's kind of jumping back into some of the historical analysis that we see in the book. You talk about four different eras to really open up the different universities.
Right.
So we have the Republican era, the Socialist period, the Open Doors period, and then the present period, which is sort of this one characterized as one of global ambition.
Right.
Yeah, and so I also notice how you connected back to what we're seeing kind of today with the higher education sector in China to maybe what we saw after World War II in the United States with sort of the radical sort of expansion through the 1960s. So if you could maybe talk about some of the, just maybe if you have any thoughts on that comparison and the periods that I mentioned as well.
Yeah, I think I was referencing the classic book, The Academic Revolution,
yep.
I think by Riesman and Jenks,
yep.
Or Jenks and Riesman, I'm confused, but they were really talking about the period you just mentioned in the U.S. post-World War II, the rapid expansion of the American university, state universities like UC Berkeley going from 15,000 students to 28,000 students, UCLA going from 15,000 to almost 30,000 students almost overnight, Michigan State, University of Michigan, Penn State. This was this massification period in U.S. higher education, but it was also an expansion of research spending and a commitment to the university as a research enterprise. This is what you see going on in China from the mid-1990s to the present. And so I've actually written an article for the Ministry of Education in China as part of my work at Renmin University about what I describe as the Chinese academic revolution.
Mm.
And so this book is arguing that China has entered a phase like that, comparable to the U.S. academic revolution, and that this new era since the mid-1990s, basically since the adoption of Projects 211 and 985, which are two national policies advanced by the Chinese Ministry of Education beginning in 1995, since the adoption of these policies and the related activities and changes and transformation of the Chinese university, I argue that this period really constitutes a new era in the reform of the Chinese university. The first three eras are well described in Ruth Hei Ho's work, famous Chinese sinologist of higher education in China, used to work at the University of Toronto. She identified the Republican period, roughly the time when China was formed as a nation state, as a republic, as opposed as to being an empire, around 1911. That period until the socialist period under Mao, and then the socialist period up into the open door period when Deng Xiaoping really reformed China in more of the open door phase. Now, many scholars look at Chinese higher education today and connect it to this open door phase. But this is where the book differs from a lot of other writing. We argue in the book, that the open door phase was a period of China catching up to the rest of the world because it fell behind during a period of stagnation when it, in essence, was closed to the outside world. So the open door period lasted roughly 20 years from the end of the Cultural Revolution to the mid-1990s, was a period of catching up, openness to the outside world, learning what they had fallen behind on. What I argue is that this new phase is no longer simply about catching up. It's about assuming a leadership position in a variety of arenas, including in the representation and the development of its cultural institutions, such as universities. It's not only that China wants to have great research universities to generate economic development, as we see them doing in the U.S. and in other countries like Germany, the U.K., Japan, but they also want to have pride in their institutions. They want Peking University to be considered, along with Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and Stanford. It's not quite there yet, but that's what they would like to see.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I think that kind of gets into my next question. Why look at these research universities specifically, and then why look at the role of the professor as sort of an actor?
Okay, that's a good question. So the ethnographic data collection, the case studies that we conducted, really I would call them ethnographic case studies. Only one, my study at Minzu, really would really fit the ethnographic tradition of extended time within and among a group of people. The others were more along the lines of ethnographic case studies. The reason I wanted to focus on faculty life is because, from my perspective, the radical transformation of the Chinese university is about research and the expansion of research, the embrace of research, the development of academic science. And when you're talking about research as an activity at a university, you're talking about the work of faculty members. Mm-hmm. And so to understand how this research transformation is taking place, or whether it's taking place, I think the key actors to engage are faculty members who actually do the research, who have different levels of expectations layered on them. How are they responding to those expectations? How are promotion and recruitment practices changing that impact faculty? So faculty are really the key players in that process. Now, we also, in so many of the academics we interviewed were also administrators. Mm-hmm. In China, many of the leading administrators are also faculty members, which is also true in academic administration to some extent in the U.S. And so even though we focused on faculty and conducted over 70 interviews with faculty members, a good number of them were also in administrative positions. And so we did get an administrative view. What the book doesn't include really is a student's point of view. And that really wasn't necessarily our focus. Mm-hmm. If we were to strengthen the study, maybe interviewing graduate students involved in research activity would have been a way to do that. We likely would not have engaged undergraduates too much.
I see. Well, it certainly adds, I think, an interesting facet that you might not see in other research projects. You know, so let's move along into the meat of the book and open up with the first university that you have, Tsinghua University, which I believe is dubbed the MIT of China. If you can maybe just give us a little bit of a history, at least, some of the interesting points. It has a fascinating foundation for university. If you can get into that a little bit.
I think Tsinghua is the most interesting case of them all, actually. Mm-hmm. It's funny, when I give talks about this book in China, I always begin my talk with saying, you know, in the U.S., we call MIT the Tsinghua of the United States. They always like that. But, Tsinghua has a very interesting history because it was founded as somewhat of a training ground for Chinese students going to the U.S. as part of the Boxer Indemnity Fund funds that the U.S. had to reinvest in China due to some overpayment. It's a complex story, right? That part.
Right.
I don't know all the details. But so basically, Tsinghua was founded somewhat as a Western-oriented university in China, at least in terms of preparing students to go abroad. And then, of course, it closed during the mid to late 30s, during the Japanese occupation of China. Tsinghua, many of the faculty and students moved to Kunming as part of Southwest United University, which really was a combination of Tsinghua, Peking, and Nankai University for a number of years. And then Tsinghua eventually was reformed, restructured under Mao's communist revolution in kind of the Soviet tradition. And then Tsinghua became famous for producing what one scholar called red engineers, basically engineers and applied scientists loyal to the Communist Party, loyal to the Communist mission. And so Tsinghua became very famous for the production of loyalist engineers. And this is somewhat of a contrast with Peking, which was a kind of a center of criticism of the society, and it sometimes led faculty and students to get different points along the way in terms of the oppositional and more progressive or liberational views that Peking faculty students tended to have. I do remember reading somewhere a famous saying that Tsinghua graduates are more likely to wind up in the government, mm-hmm. and Peking graduates are more likely to wind up in jail. I think that's an exaggeration, but there is a somewhat of a resistant or oppositional point of view as part of Peking that's less a part of Tsinghua. And so, of course, Tsinghua has really become the top university in China in terms of applied science and engineering, and in terms of building these kind of entrepreneurial capital-driven ties to right. business and industry, mm-hmm. and to developing collaborative university industry research projects. No other university in China is close to Tsinghua in this regard. Maybe Zhejiang University in Hangzhou is pretty strong, too. They have a great industrial park there, too. But there are a few industrial parks around the world that rival Tsinghua's Tuse Park. It's right. just pretty amazing. Right. You can find Google and other kinds of companies headquartered there.
Yeah, I think in the book you lay out a lot of the companies that are there, and it's Google, I think you had Microsoft, Samsung, I believe, is there yeah. as well, the Korean company. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that Tuse Park and sort of how the university really cultivates its talent, and you know how professors are working with working at to do this with their research as well.
Well, they really try to. Part of it's aimed at graduate students and the next generation of innovators, and creating incubator opportunities in Tuse Park for graduate students who have new ideas. Mm-hmm. Most of the new ideas don't go anywhere, but giving them a seed money and a location to develop products or ideas and really rub elbows with entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, that's the idea. This park is really an elaboration of that idea, borrowed to a great extent from the U.S. and some of the things we see at Stanford and in Boston and around Route 128 and Silicon Valley and California. It's that kind of idea, is to bring entrepreneurs, innovators, venture capitalists, and really faculty and mostly doctoral students who are doing research together, rubbing elbows, sharing ideas, learning from one another, and even mentoring doctoral students. Now, I should add that, not everyone in China, just like in the U.S., is happy about this model of the university. Mm-hmm. And so just like in the U.S., where maybe traditionalists or folks in the humanities and social sciences, science areas, who sometimes feel left out or marginalized by this new vision of the entrepreneurial university, we found some of the same kind of resistance at Tsinghua. Many of the faculty did not like this kind of a model of a university and saw it somehow sacrificing kind of this notion of pure knowledge or knowledge for the sake of knowledge.
Right.
So some of the same tensions around what might call academic capitalism exist in China as you see at U.S. universities.
Hmm. Okay. Well, maybe going on to that a little bit further, sort of understanding the faculty and how sort of as their university has sort of internationalized or maybe modernized, as we like to say,
right.
what kind of pressures are the faculty there facing, and sort of how are they facing that?
Now you're talking about Chinese universities broadly and not just Tsinghua, right? Or are you referencing just Tsinghua?
I believe in the...
More broadly?
In the Tsinghua chapter, it talks about sort of how because of the push for, the pressures that they have to have for internationalization and pushing them so high
right.
into this sort of global knowledge-based economic leader
right.
that it's even harder perhaps on their faculty there to,
right.
publish and research and do other things.
Yeah, this is a theme of all four cases, actually.
I see.
It was very pronounced at Tsinghua and Peking and Renmin, less so at Minzu. I should add that for most scholars of the Chinese university, they would not group Minzu into this category.
Hmm.
Minzu is really not the kind of research university that you would compare to Renmin, Tsinghua, and Peking. However, Minzu was included in some of the same major Ministry of Education projects because of its importance as a minority university. And I wanted to include it because I think minority affairs in China, just like in the U.S., are an important aspect of the role of the university in society. And so I felt it was critical to include Minzu. But even at Minzu, these pressures around internationalization and publishing and academic capitalism, generating revenue, generating grants through one's research, these pressures are throughout universities in China that are included in projects 211 and 985. I might add that project 211 includes about 100 universities, and project 985 includes around 39 universities.
Mm-hmm.
All of those universities included in those two national initiatives are targeted for development as major research universities. And
right.
so the faculty at these universities experience incredible pressure related to generating revenue, publishing, and getting engaged internationally.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine being a 50-year-old professor at one of these universities who doesn't speak English.
Mm.
A lot of the international journals, they conduct their business in English. That's an incredible disadvantage for a scholar to have to deal with if they have pressure to publish internationally.
Right.
And there are many fields in China where publishing internationally doesn't really serve the transformative needs or goals of your research.
Mm-hmm.
I remember interviewing a professor at Renmin University who was talking about the pressure on rural development scholars to publish internationally, and yet their research was about transforming the rural countryside in China in terms of developing and creating economic opportunities for rural peasants. The issues didn't necessarily appeal or relate to a variety of international issues. And so they felt the need to publish their findings in China relative to Chinese policymakers, not necessarily in international journals. And for them, it didn't seem suitable for them to be pursuing international outlets, and it distanced them from the ideas of transformation and social change within their own country. And so there are a lot of problems and complexities with this international push in China. And there are many faculty who resist some of these challenges that they're presented mm-hmm. with. They just don't always make sense for them.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that definitely, if you go and read the book, you'll definitely see that under all the universities, it's listed as internationalization, the pressures, what they have to face, sort of what's going on with their
right.
own personal research and things like that. So I think that's reflected very nicely in the book. For the sake of time, I think we'll go on to Peking
sure.
University, or as it's known locally, Beida. I think
Beida.
Is what everyone would refer to in China.
Yep.
And maybe you kind of jumped on it a little bit, but kind of talk about Beida's legacy and I think you mentioned like the May 4th movement and,
yep.
and some of these other reforms or protests, I guess, in the book as well, if you want to take that one.
Well, Beida, also like Tsinghua, early on had a lot of Western influences operating on the university. But unlike Tsinghua, it found ways and it followed a path somewhat different from Tsinghua, in that many of those democratic, progressive impulses found root at Beida and have existed throughout its history. Still today, there are many outspoken academics and students at Beida. Of course, Beida is famous for its students and faculty playing a key role in the May 4th, 1919 cultural movements in China. And of course, many Beida students played a key role in the Tiananmen protests in 89. And so Beida has, throughout its history, been a source of, been a key institution in providing a critical voice to some extent to what's going on in China. Mm-hmm. That's not always easy, and sometimes faculty and students have paid a price for that, and that's still the reality today. But again, Beida still is seen and is looked to for its unique voice in terms of offering a critical analysis of Chinese society and government and politics. And there's a certain degree of acceptance of that and expectation of that. It was also the key site of personnel reform in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. when administrators and government officials tried to reform faculty life, basically, in China, and introduce more bureaucratized modalities in terms of faculty promotion, faculty recruitment. They didn't entirely succeed in reforming the faculty personnel policies. They did make many changes, though, that eventually trickled down to other institutions throughout Chinese society. You know, in China, Peking University is kind of like Harvard to some extent in the U.S., and there's this idea of isomorphism, or it's also talked about as institutional drift. Mm. And so in some sense, every university in China, maybe with the exception of Tsinghua, wants to be more like Beida or Peking. And so many of the personnel changes that took place at Beida in the early 2000s are evident at other universities throughout China. They were evident at all the universities we visited. And so there's much more of an institutionalized, clear set of guidelines now to recruiting and hiring faculty, and in terms of the promotion process being much more clearly spelled out. In the past, some of these things were left a little bit to guangxi, which basically is a Chinese word for connections and ties and friendships and those kinds of things. And that was seen as counterproductive to creating a more competitive environment for encouraging faculty productivity. Okay. And so the government officials and university bureaucrats basically wanted faculty life to be a little bit more competitive and to increase productivity. And they partially succeeded in changing the policies to do that. They didn't get all everything they wanted, but they made enough changes to create a different environment for faculty life in China.
Right.
So now there are a lot of fairly clear rules in terms of publications. In fact, one of my criticisms in the book is that there's almost too much rigidity to the promotion procedures in China. Too many things are scored. Mm-hmm. I think it was Einstein that said that some things that can be counted shouldn't be counted, or some of the things that count the most can't be counted. But in Chinese promotion processes, I think there's a tendency to want to count or score everything.
Yep,
So there's a little bit of an emphasis on, for example, getting points if you publish in an international journal versus publishing in a national journal. And there's not always a differentiation between writing, say, a critical essay versus an empirically based study. Those are sometimes treated the same way. And that's typically not the case in the U.S., where we involve faculty much more in the peer review process. And so we wouldn't necessarily count everything the same. And sometimes we wouldn't even produce a number or a quotient to describe someone's performance. It's more diverse than that in the U.S. And that's probably still a shortcoming in China.
Right, right. Yeah, I think you mentioned specifically quotas in there for, you know, hitting a mark on.
There's also quotas in terms of the number of associate and full professors that a department may be allowed to have.
Right.
This creates a different kind of problem in that imagine that you and I are working in the same sociology department and with 10 other associate professors. And there's one opening in our department for a full professor, and the government has only allocated one opening to our department for next year. You and I might meet the minimum qualifications to be promoted along with our 10 colleagues. So all 12 of us may submit materials to be promoted to full professor, but only one of us can be promoted.
Right.
So this creates competition between you and I and you and I amongst our colleagues. This is very different from the U.S., where there's typically not a quota or a limit to the number of full professors a particular department can have. But in China, top institutions have specific quotas on the number of positions at the level of associate professor, which is known as Fu Jiaoshou, and the number at full professor, which is called Zhang Jiaoshou. And so this creates a more competitive environment among colleagues. At times, it's counterproductive.
Right.
I might not tell you everything I'm doing if I have to compete with you for the next promotion.
It also discourages
collaboration to
right.
some extent. Why would you and I collaborate if we're competing for the same one spot in our department? So I think this is a problematic area.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's move on, I think, to the next university you guys have in the book, and you've already mentioned it, but Renmin University or
yep.
People's University, and a much different history of its founding and with its connection to the CCP. So do you want to discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, the Renmin plays a very close relationship to the Chinese government. It's founded by the Chinese Communist Party in the early 1950s. I think that the central theme of that chapter really focused on internationalization, in part because Renmin has maybe the top international affairs program in China, or at least one of the top two or three programs. It's very strong in international law also. And so many Renmin scholars are often quoted and turned to by the New York Times or Washington Post to comment on various geopolitical issues. And so Renmin has many faculty who are heavily involved and are considered leaders in the international realm. Plus, the university has really committed great resources to internationalizing campus. They adopted an international summer term a few years back, and now they bring in tons of students over the summertime, foreign teachers as well, and many of the classes are taught in English. Of course, that's always been a problem in China in terms of recruiting foreign students, is the Chinese language can be challenging for many foreigners, and so they've introduced a lot of English language classes as part of internationalization. And so that case study really focuses on the internationalization of top universities. By the way, almost all the key points we make in the Renmin chapter could also have been made in the Peking and the Tsinghua chapters too. Both of those universities are also highly internationalized.
Right.
But of course, as some of the faculty at Renmin pointed out, there are some negatives to the rapid internationalization of the Chinese university, and some of the more critical scholars fear that important aspects of Chinese culture that are part of the Chinese university may be lost along the way in this rapid internationalization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you specifically mentioned that, you know, is this a new form of colonialism, sort of adopting the Western model? That's something that they specifically had mentioned or were concerned about. Okay.
A couple scholars at Renmin were very critical of it and felt and used that term, colonialism, cultural colonialism. It's a little bit of an odd use because the Chinese government and the Chinese university officials are choosing to move in this direction. But by the same token, you could argue that if you want to be engaged in academic science at a global level, you have little choice but to play by the rules of the world's most developed universities, which tend to be in the West.
Right, right.
So on the other hand, there is a sense of not really having a choice.
Absolutely.
And of course, global science is mostly conducted in English.
Yep.
And so that's another issue that, that many Chinese scholars have to deal with. I mentioned that earlier.
Right. And this this chapter also brings out something that hasn't been brought up before, is the gender differences with professors.
Yep.
And the barriers that they face. This has been a hot topic in Chinese society right now.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of new books that have come out recently. Do you want to kind of talk about some of those?
Yeah. And actually, I published an article a couple of years ago on the experiences of women academics in China. And so in China, women constitute about 50% of the faculty, but only about 10% of the full professors.
Mm.
And so something happens along the way. You know, this happens in the U.S., it's actually a global phenomenon. That women don't progress to the highest levels. In the corporate world, we call it the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
But there's a variety of reasons, one of which is China is still a rather traditional society in terms of family life. And so women academics describe to me a reality of having two, sometimes three jobs,
mm-hmm.
right? They have their faculty job. They have their job managing their home life and preparing dinner. The third job, by the way, was tutoring their one child.
Right.
Given the pressure that Chinese families feel and the pressure that's placed on their children in a society with a one-child policy, it's imperative that that child does extremely well in school.
Right.
And so when Chinese children get home from school, they go to school at home most of the evening. And that task of tutoring the child often falls on the woman.
Mm.
And so many women who I interviewed who were academics described having this third job. And so these kinds of pressures really make it very difficult for women to advance to beyond associate professor to full professor. Because as you know, oftentimes in order to publish, to get research grants, to become the highest ranking professors that you can be, oftentimes that comes out of family life, some of that extra time and effort. Many women either don't want to or can't devote that extra time. Sometimes they don't want to. And this, I can recall many women saying to me, I'm going to have one child in my lifetime. Why would I sacrifice time that I can spend with my child to do research or do extra work at home when I only have that one chance? So some of it is pressure and a feeling that they don't have a choice, and other times it's a choice they really want to make to put family first. Now, of course, men in Chinese society typically don't face those same sets of choices.
Right, absolutely.
This is an issue necessitates that from my perspective, greater institutional support mechanisms for women and mothers at the Chinese university. I think that this is something that is probably needed.
Absolutely. So moving along for time's sake, talked a little bit about
yes.
it, but Minzu University, the next,
okay,
the next and final university, if you want to introduce Minzu University, and then also maybe just a little bit about ethnic divisions in China
okay.
today.
So Minzu is a very special university for me because I spent a year there. Living there and teaching there. It's a great university. It's not typically considered one of China's top research universities. However, in the area, in various fields related to ethnic minority issues like ethnology, sociology, minority language and literature, it's the best university in China in those areas. So they have really world-class faculty in those fields.
Mm.
So in China, there are 55 ethnic minority groups officially recognized by the Chinese government. There's 56 ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
The Han majority constitutes about 90% of the population, and the 55 remaining Minzu means national ethnic group, the 55 remaining Minzu are considered minority groups. Okay, so those, but the fact is there, the government recognizes 55 ethnic groups, but there are many, many more. Some of those ethnic groups are a conglomeration of many ethnic groups. In fact, in the 1950s, when Mao launched the ethnic classification project, he sent hundreds of ethnologists and sociologists into the field to classify ethnicities in China. Mm-hmm. Over 400 Chinese groups filed for status as an ethnic minority group, but eventually they settled on 55. And so Minzu represents all of those ethnic groups. And as I mentioned earlier, about 60 to 70% of the student body are ethnic minorities. So this is a very special campus, and it also puts a lot of money and effort into the humanities, the arts mainly, dance, music, ethnic folk dance and music. You know, one of the hardest concert tickets in Beijing to get is a seat at a Minzu University minority student production.
Very nice.
The talent, the singing and musical talent and the dance talent at Minzu is really off the charts. Mm. And so those tickets are hard to get. But what's interesting about Minzu is you can walk around in the evening and you can see various ethnic groups, groups of students practicing various dance performances, rituals, very interesting experience. Another thing that's interesting, not all ethnic minorities in China speak the national language. Mm-hmm. And so Minzu has a number of students who actually come to the university to learn Hanyu Putonghua, which is Mandarin to most Americans. And so they have many students there who actually don't speak the national language, but are learning the language. They take special classes for a year or two before they actually start at the university. And so the diversity of ethnic backgrounds at Minzu is quite amazing.
Right.
It's very different than being at Beida or Tsinghua or Renmin. What's really quite fun is around Minzu are many ethnic minority restaurants. And so some of the best food, I think, in Beijing is right around the gates of Minzu University. But anyways, I taught three or four classes during my Fulbright there. Had a wonderful experience, met students from Tibet and from Xinjiang, and really enjoyed interacting with them. And I got a much deeper appreciation of ethnic diversity in China and some of the challenges, actually, that the Chinese government faces in really promoting national identity. It's not an easy thing in China.
Right, right. And maybe quickly, can you talk about how the professors at Minzu University, sort of their role with the students coming from these different backgrounds, how does that interplay work?
Well, many of the, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about Minzu is how serious the professors are in their commitment to ethnic minority affairs in China. And so many of the professors actually are from the rural countryside and from ethnic minority backgrounds, or if they're Han faculty, if they're Han, part of the Han majority, they're very committed to the ethnic diversity issues at Minzu. And so it's a supportive environment for students from diverse backgrounds and quite a unique university in that regard. And so I found the faculty to be incredibly knowledgeable and learned around ethnicity and race. Many of them have studied abroad in the U.S. and other countries, and have traveled to the U.S. to study multicultural issues in the U.S. I met professors who were experts on American Native American tribes and languages, etc. We knew some of the same scholars, actually, but they had gone to the U.S. to study the Navajo tribal colleges and Indian reservation schools and the ways in which bilingual education was practiced on some of the tribal reservations in the U.S. and in the schools in the U.S. And they were very knowledgeable and interested in this aspect of cultural and linguistic diversity, because these are big challenges in China. One of the big challenges that some of these professors deal with is how do you promote ethnic minorities establishing or having a sense of national identity, being able to speak the national language, and yet how do you help them to preserve and strengthen their own local cultures, their own linguistic abilities tied to their particular region or community. You know, that's a global challenge that countries around the world face.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I know you have to go teach a class.
Yeah, I've got to talk for another 3 hours tonight.
Absolutely. So I guess just wrapping up with our final question here. I do appreciate your time, but. What's sort of next on your plate? What's the next project you got coming up?
Okay. Well, I'll be leaving for China next week, actually. I'm working on a study with a doctoral student at Renmin University, and we're looking at differences in the dissertation and graduate experience of social science doctoral students at UCLA and at Renmin University. And so basically we're trying to understand how is the dissertation process and the preparation for that dissertation different among Chinese doctoral students in the social sciences compared to U.S. doctoral students, and we're mostly focusing on Renmin and UCLA. So we're in the middle of that project, and that's kind of next on my plate.
Okay.
And to continue working on my Chinese course.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I thank you, Dr. Robert Rhodes, for agreeing to come here, and I encourage everyone to go check out his book, which is coming out later in the year, China's Rising Research Universities, A New Era of Global Ambition. Thank you very much, and I hope everyone has learned something. Thank you.